Well, we're beginning today a new series in the book of Ecclesiastes. I wonder what you know about the book of Ecclesiastes.
Seasons.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. It's not always the lightest of reads. It's not exactly full of joy line after line if you've ever read it through. You know those sections that you sometimes get, those helpful sections you sometimes get at the start of a Bible where it gives you various verses that you can turn to when you're feeling anxious or lonely or down or guilty or grieving, that kind of thing? Ecclesiastes never turns up in any of those lists. If you were picking a list of key topics, I think, to address in the library of God's words, then I imagine that the pointlessness of life wouldn't be particularly high on your pecking order. And yet that appears to be the tone of much of the book of Ecclesiastes. Time and again as you read it through, we're left with the question, voiced by this book in the very bluntest of terms, what's the point in life? What's the point? And it's not even as if that question is raised at the beginning as a means to a long and joyful and enthusiastic answer that follows. Ecclesiastes is not a trite answer to such a hard question, nor does it appear at times even to be a particularly definite one. Which begs the question, I guess, as to what it's doing in the Bible. And many people have asked that over the centuries. I mean, let's be honest, God. Let's just sit down and be honest. Is Ecclesiastes really the best way to address this issue of the meaning of life? Is it not all just a little bit uncertain as you read it through? A little bit depressing? A little bit grey? And therefore a little dangerous? But that, I think, is exactly the point. That, I think, is exactly the point. You see, moving to simple, to trite answers is the worst thing to do on questions like this, on the very point, the very meaning of life, isn't it? Because they're not mere questions, are they? They're not mere questions. They go far beyond the mere intellectual, well, I wonder about, to the raw, the emotional, the gut-wrenching, the sometimes simply overwhelming. It feels like, well, tell me what you think as you listen to the opening words of Ecclesiastes. And for the moment, don't turn to it. Just listen. You're well trained, but for the moment, don't turn to it. Just listen. And consider whether these opening words don't put words to your own experience from time to time. The words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does a man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, but the sea is never full. To the places where the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new. It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Doesn't that capture your experience from time to time? Perhaps even now, at the moment. Oh, I mean, if you're asked, you'll do the good British thing, won't you? And you'll say, no, I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. But actually, in the privacy of your own head, is this not what you think from time to time? As you lie awake at night, or maybe in the morning as you prepare to face a new day, or in a moment of quiet when things have briefly slowed down and you have a chance to think, or even in those long moments of quiet that seem to make up so much of the day. Or is that just me and the writer to the Ecclesiastes? See, what's the point? What's the point? It just goes on, this cycle of life. Day after day, and what really matters? It's not as if it lasts, is it? I mean, here am I, one insignificant person living an insignificant life among the billions currently alive on earth. And that's before you consider the scope of time and history and the billions who have gone before and the billions who will come after. What's the point? What's the point? See, don't tell me the Bible's an irrelevant book with nothing to say to the modern world. Because Ecclesiastes here is giving full voice to that sense of meaninglessness that we all feel at times, don't we? This is no ivory tower writer writing in the abstract. It's as if he's completely entering the world of his readers, this teacher. It's like that he walks down from the pulpit, this teacher or preacher, as sometimes he's referred to, and he takes a seat amongst his congregation, and he says, well, this is what life feels like sometimes, isn't it? Isn't this what it's all about? It's just meaningless. I mean, what's the point? Don't you feel like that sometimes? So, of course, it's not enough, is it, just simply to share our pain and our frustration, because to do so gives us no hope. Actually, what we want is answers, isn't it? Unless, of course, there aren't any. No, there are answers, don't worry. But they're not simple. They're not simple, trite answers, as we might be tempted to run off. There are answers, not simplistic ones, not blessed thoughts that will make everything okay if you stick them by a picture of a nice puppy. Now, the writer of Ecclesiastes is not going to make things easy for us over these next few weeks as we examine these issues. He wants us to wrestle with the reality of what we feel. He's going to make us take this seriously. That's why he enters so fully into the way we often feel. Two things for us to notice at this stage. Firstly, we see something of what God is like through his inclusion of Ecclesiastes in his word. He gives voice to our deepest fears and struggles and questions. He gives them voice, which means it is never wrong to express them to him. He gives voice to them himself. Doubts and fears and questions and worries and despair will never be dismissed as irrelevant by a God who speaks through Ecclesiastes. We are given voice to those things in his word. But you see, just as we are given voice to speak in his words, so we are given ears to listen to what that word has to say to us in return. Secondly, the fact that the eloquence of the beginning of Ecclesiastes strikes such a chord with us, and it does, doesn't it? That empathy and that understanding that we feel with the writer and his frustration at these feelings of meaninglessness which assault him point to the fact that there must be something more. There must be something more. You see, if we were just cogs, minor cogs in the passage of time, here to fill our 80 years, breed to ensure the survival of the human race, and then fade away to be forgotten by those who follow as just another bundle of chemicals reused by the natural world of which we're a part. If that is all we are, so that our lives are meaningless as individuals, well then why is this such a problem for us? Why is this such a problem for us? Yeah, there is something deep within us, isn't there? That struggles with these issues, that feels the pain and the frustration and even the anger of similar experiences to what the writer seems to be going through. There must be more than this. There must be more. I must be more than this because I matter. Not in the sense that I matter more than you, but in the sense of I matter. And those that I love matter as individuals, and those that I have lost matter. You see, our very struggle with this question, our inability to let it go and to resign ourselves to futility, point to something more about us. That we are more than just a bundle of chemicals. They point, in the words of next week's passage, chapter 3 and verse 11, to eternity in our hearts. Put there by the one who made us as individuals, not as mere bundles of chemicals. See, the very question being asked at the heart of Ecclesiastes is part of the answer. It's not a trite one, but it is a pointer to a glimpse of what is truly real, a glimpse of true reality. So the writer to the Ecclesiastes is wrestling with this question of the meaning, the point of life. But we might want to ask ourselves, well, who is he? Who is the bloke who's writing this letter? Well, many suggested it's King Solomon, because he describes himself in chapter 1, verse 1, as the teacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. If you're desperate, you can turn to it now, page 668. He describes himself as David's son, and because Solomon, of course, was known as a man of great wisdom, who wrote other books of wisdom, like Proverbs and Song of Songs. Now, it's not of vital importance, but it's worth just talking about it briefly. I think it's unlikely to have been Solomon himself for a number of reasons. Because later on in the book, he's not exactly complimentary about kings. You look at chapter 5 and verses 7 and 8, and chapter 10 and verse 20. Kings come across as a bit of bullies, actually, not particularly complimentary. And in verse 12 of chapter 1, he describes himself as the one who was king over Israel, indicating that he is no longer, but Solomon reigned until his death. And unlike Proverbs and Song of Songs, he never actually names himself as Solomon. He makes allusions to the idea that he might be Solomon. It's far more likely, I think, that this is another author writing the book who is making obvious allusions to Solomon, who wants us to think about him. Not that he's claiming to be Solomon, but he's putting himself in the shoes of Solomon, if you like, in the line of wisdom, in the line of the king known for his wisdom. And so he addresses this biggest of questions. What's the point of life? Is it all just meaningless? And chapter 2 finds him looking for that meaning. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 9. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. He's trying every avenue to find out what gives meaning to life, isn't he? Pleasure and building projects, a legacy to leave after him, and wealth and sex. All of them tried and tested to see what's going to give meaning and value to life. All the places where people still today look for meaning and value in life. The Bible's quite a relevant book, really, isn't it? And his verdict? Well, it's in chapter 10, verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done, and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. And the writer of Ecclesiastes isn't alone in that discovery. History is littered with people who have climbed their mountains of success to find no satisfaction at the top. It doesn't work. And actually, as the teacher continues on, we then get to the heart of what the real problem is, what his real issue is, the rock that he butts up against time and time again as he searches for meaning, the seemingly inescapable reality that renders pleasure and achievement and wealth and life itself seemingly irrelevant. Death. Then I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will also overtake me. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. See, in the end, even wisdom, that noble virtue which the teacher has trumpeted as it has guided him through his searching, even wisdom cannot escape death. Yes, wisdom is better than foolishness, as light is better than darkness, but the wise man still dies. And we're left with the same question there, the same problem there that we had back in chapter 1. Chapter 1, verse 11, there is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Chapter 2, verse 16, for the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. And so the teacher is left with death casting its shadow over all of life. And it shapes the view of the whole of life as he continues. So what's the implication? So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labour under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom and knowledge and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labours under the sun? All his days his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. You can't take it with you when you go. You can't take it with you where you go. Whether wealth or achievements, whatever they may be, good or bad, you can't take it with you when you go. Death gets the final word. And faced with that reality, says the teacher, what's the point? Well, Happy New Year. Ecclesiastes, it's not a place for simple, trite answers, is it? But you see, our writer isn't quite finished yet. He's not finished yet. Verse 24, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. And we have a new entry into the field. Good things that are not toiled for and laboured for, but good things that are gifts from God. And we get the first flickerings of hope in Ecclesiastes, that God gives good gifts to be enjoyed. Life has pleasures, simple pleasures and profound pleasures. And we are to acknowledge and to enjoy them as good gifts from God. That the everyday stuff of life is not a mere means to an end, fuel to keep us going in the cycle. It is a gift from the life giver. The flickerings of hope. And yet the eagle-eyed amongst you would have kept reading, wouldn't you? Because at the end of verse 26, we're told that this too is meaningless. They're chasing after the wind. You see, our flickerings of hope appear to have been extinguished. From being encouraged to enjoy the things of life that God gives us, all of a sudden they too are meaningless, because the teacher is back with his big problem, isn't he? We haven't dodged this bullet. Death is still the problem. Ecclesiastes, not a place for simple, trite answers, is it? But dig a little. Dig a little deeper, and Ecclesiastes has more to say. Things that will begin to change our perspective and the way we think on these things. Things to begin to open our eyes to a bigger picture that is going on under the surface here. There are three things for us to see. Two of them here in Ecclesiastes, one looking beyond. Three things for us to say that the writer is pointing us towards. Firstly, the teacher has set us a context by telling us that we are dealing with a broken world. He's told us that we're dealing with a broken world. Verses 12 to 15 of chapter 1. You'll notice we skipped over them earlier on. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under heaven. What a heavy burden God has laid on men. I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. You see what he's told us there? He's told us that the world is twisted. It is broken. It is off kilter. Think of a car where the engine is making strange noises as you drive along. It runs, but something is telling you it's not quite right. It's not quite what it should be. Now, Ecclesiastes is never quoted in the New Testament, but it is alluded to in Romans chapter 8 and verses 20 to 21. It says this, Paul writes, "For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, God, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God." You see, that word frustration used there of creation is the same word as this word meaningless, which so dominates the book of Ecclesiastes as we keep reading it through. And Paul is talking in Romans there about the effects of the fall, the effects of sin on creation around us, our sin. He's saying that all is not quite right because of the fall, because of sin, that the world is thrown off balance. It's not as it should be. It doesn't run smoothly. That there are consequences for creation from our rebellion against God. It doesn't quite work. Remember what God said to Adam after his sin, was he delivered the curse as a result, the consequences of sin. He said the work which had previously been a joy to him, tending the Garden of Eden, would become instead toil. Hard labour, the language of Ecclesiastes, Genesis 3, verses 17 to 19. That was part of the burden that God laid on humankind as a consequence of sin. When we rebel against God, there are consequences. It is a continual reminder that things are not all right, that things are not as they should be. They illustrate the broken relationship with creation, illustrates the broken relationship of humanity with God. Things are not as they should be. It's a reminder, it's a continual call to humanity to seek after God in repentance and faith, to put things right where we have broken them. You see, humanity, you and me, we were created to know and to enjoy God, to find our satisfaction and our delight in Him. As those who are made by him, given meaning in him, given dignity and worth as individuals in him. Do you remember we said that we empathise with the teacher at the beginning of Ecclesiastes because his words strike a chord with us, don't they? This is how we feel sometimes. We feel that we and those around us have significance and value as individuals. They matter. They're not just going through the cycle of life. They're not just recycled chemicals in the passage of time. Because that's how God made us. That's how God made us and what He made us for. Himself. And the problem is that we've rejected Him and we've faced the consequences. That things are twisted and lacking. See, that frustration that we feel, that dissatisfaction that life is there to point us to, is there to point us to where we will truly find satisfaction, so that we will not settle for less, so that we will seek rescue from a broken world. More than that, as Romans suggested, as we seek rescue and restoration alongside a broken world, as we come back into relationship with the living God. As we seek His forgiveness and as we enjoy His grace. See, the teacher's told us right here at the beginning of Ecclesiastes, we are living in a broken world. And his expressions of hopelessness and meaninglessness come from within that context to draw our attention to that brokenness. We're living in a broken world. But secondly, the teacher has also told us subtly throughout that he is not looking at the full picture in what he has to say here. Verse 3 of chapter 1. What does a man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? See, that's the key phrase, under the sun. If you keep reading through the whole of those first two chapters, it's repeated 9 times in those opening chapters. 11 if you include under heaven in chapter 1 verse 13 and then chapter 2 verse 3. Again and again and again. And it comes with eye-popping frequency at the end of the chapter. Chapter 2, remember we reached the conclusion? I hated life. Under the sun comes in verse 17, 18, 19, 20, 22. Again and again and again it's coming through. The teacher's field of vision is restricted. It's restricted, and by repeating that phrase, he is drawing our attention to it again and again. I'm talking about what is under the sun. See, aside from his brief mention of the burden of God in verse 13 of chapter 1, and the gifts of God in verse 24 and 20 to 26 of chapter 2, his reference point is entirely of this world. It is entirely of what is under the sun. So the meaning that he attempts to find is in pleasure, and in building projects, and in wealth, and in sex. How can he find meaning in the stuff of life in the here and now? And the simple answer is, he can't. He can't. Because meaning in life is dependent on the transcendent. Because we are made by a God in heaven, for a God in heaven. That he is the one who gives our lives meaning. What is under the sun is not the full picture. And it cannot satisfy, because it is not what we were made for. And therefore it is not what we long for. And the writer says, and it's because we are made by a God in heaven, for a God in heaven, and he is the one who in the end, he is the one who gives our lives meaning. And the writer of Ecclesiastes does that. He tells us that, but he waits till the end of the book to tell us it. So if you were to look at chapter 12 and verses 13 and 14, his final two verses. Now all this has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. You see, in the end, everything that we do has meaning because death is not the end. And we are not forgotten. God the judge gives dignity and meaning to every action and thought and word. Meaning is given because consequences are real. See, under the sun is not the full extent of reality. There is a God to answer to. There is a God to answer to. But that leaves us with a bigger problem than what we started with, doesn't it? That leaves us with a bigger problem than we started with. Because if my life is given meaning by a God who judges every thought and word and deed, then I'm in trouble. I've got a bigger problem. Because more of them than I would care to mention will come up very short. So actually now we find ourselves with two issues staring us in the face. The reality of death, which the teacher has brought us face to face within these chapters. And then we have the reality of judgment. Of our good and our evil acts, thoughts and words by a perfect God. And suddenly faced with those two things, the question, what's the point, is the least of our worries, isn't it? Until we see Jesus. Until we see Jesus. Because he is the one who has defeated death, isn't he? He is the one who has defeated death, that great wall that faced the teacher at every turn. He couldn't get away from it. But no, Jesus has defeated death so that death does not have the final word, as I suggested earlier on. Death does not have the final word, but rather the life giver does. And Jesus, of course, is the one who has faced our judgment for us on the cross, who has taken the punishment for all that we have done wrong in thought and word and deeds. And he has given us his perfection so that we can stand with confidence before a holy, perfect God. And more than that, he is the one who has given us the right to be called children of God. He has given us value and dignity and worth and love beyond our wildest dreams. He's given us a hope and a future. He's given us love and acceptance. So that in the end, we do not need to find or earn or achieve meaning, because it's given to us. See, what's the point? What's the point? The point is to know and to enjoy the one who is the source of all beauty and wonder and joy and delight. To enjoy the one who has beaten death and who offers us life. That's the point. That's the point. He is the point. See, next time those feelings of pointlessness threaten to overwhelm you, next time those feelings of meaningless threaten to overwhelm you in the middle of the night or first thing in the morning or whatever other point it is for you, then remember that that dissatisfaction that you feel is the result of a broken world. It's pointing you towards something more. And it wants to point you away to the fact that there is anything under the sun that could possibly bring you satisfaction. And instead, fill your thoughts with your mind with thoughts of how good and how kind and how wonderful God is. The love and acceptance that he lavishes on us. And ask you to ask him to help you to enjoy him. Because he's the point. And he gives himself to us. Let's pray together. Father, you are so wonderfully, graciously kind to give us a book like Ecclesiastes, which on one level threatens to depress us and leaves us asking questions as to what it's doing there. But actually, your very word gives voice to our deepest, darkest fears. And then you offer us hope by showing us once again that that dissatisfaction is because this world is broken, because we have broken it, because we've broken our relationship with you. And also that this world, what is under the sun, is not all that there is. But you stand there waiting for us. We thank you for the good gifts that you give us to enjoy in the everyday life. Food and drink and family and friends and relationships. And all those wonderful things that we have to enjoy. Please help us to enjoy them as good gifts from you. But Lord, guard us from seeking to find our satisfaction in those good things. And instead, Lord, call us back to yourself and show us more of yourself, that we might find true joy and delight, point and meaning, love and acceptance, dignity and worth in the God who has given himself for us, that he might call us to himself. We thank you that you stand with us. We thank you that you rescue us. We thank you that you give us more than we could possibly imagine or dream of. We worship and praise you as the good, kind, wonderful God. And we ask that we would find our joy, our delight, our satisfaction in you. And that as we do that, you would use us as examples to show others too. Those also searching for meaning and point in life, where they might find it and enjoy it forever. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.